Our next keynote speaker is Sister Maureen McBride. Maureen may well be better known outside Australia than she is in Australia. She spent the last 12 years in Rome as the congregational leader of the Sisters of Our Lady of the Missions. She has extensive experience in leadership, in formation and in education. She's worked in formation in the Philippines as well as here. Her congregation is expanding. It's in 23 countries across the world, and new foundations have been made since 2008. So that's something really quite special. So I'd like to invite Sister Maureen McBride to speak with us.
So good morning, everyone. It's really great to be here with you for this mission conference. I'm feeling a bit daunted to follow Steve's wonderful presentation this morning. And it was something that was so uplifting when we look at mission of God, and our partnership in mission with God. My topic is leadership and mission, and I will really be speaking from story, from the experience of leadership and mission. I travel a great deal, more or less 8 months of the year, and so I know airports inside out, and I've endured most of the vicissitudes of international travel, including hours spent at security checks and immigration. As well as the routine ups and downs of air travel, there are often very inspiring moments. Not so long ago, I was returning to Rome from Asia. The 12-hour journey began in Singapore in the middle of the night. I was fortunate to have that very rare opportunity of being upgraded to business class. Very rare. In spite of the joy and luxury of being able to stretch out my legs, I was unable to sleep. So contented myself with pondering the visit I had just made, the encounters I had enjoyed, and catching up on the latest movies. Planes are literally the only places where I can follow movies these days. I had a window seat with a clear panorama of the galaxy of stars and the warm glow of the rounded, silvery gold moon. We were flying above the Middle East when I became conscious of an almost imperceptible shift in the mood of the sky. I glanced behind me and to the left side of the plane and saw that it was still the deepest of night. But as I looked towards the east, I witnessed the pitch black that cushioned the stars slowly soften to shades of deep indigo, purple velvet, mauve, pinks, and eventually various delicate blues. Far below, I could see pinpricks of light twinkling in the crystal clear silhouettes of tiny mountain villages. There was a pause. Then I glimpsed an almost imperceptible tiny spark. And the sun's glow burst in strident red and dazzling orange, announcing the birth of a new day rippling across the horizon. Brilliant and breathtaking colors of crimson, gold, and yellow filled the sky. Over North Africa, clouds tumbled and cascaded into mountains and valleys, and mild turbulence shook us as we approached our descent into Rome. It was indeed a sumptuous dawn that awakened the world that day and beckoned me once again to hope. I recognize the insight of Aruntai Hati Roy, author of The God of Small Things, when she wrote, Not only is another world possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. The images I have just described capture something of my experience in leadership over the past 11 years. When I took up my mandate, I was very naive and inexperienced. After 11 years, I have to say, I think I'm pretty unshockable. While the role of leadership has stretched and challenged me beyond all imaginings, it has also been an incredible journey and has certainly offered me extraordinary privileges and blessings. To return to the image of that magnificent flight, leadership involves checking the instruments, verifying the maps, setting the flight path. As leaders, we constantly scan the horizon to explore a global perspective in order to better understand the particular, the point of arrival. Inevitably, there are mild shudders and tremors that provoke uncertainty and increase levels of anxiety. Sometimes there are moments of wild turbulence that generate fear, both within and from without, that lead us into uncharted territories, and we can only move forward in faith. At a very personal level, I was just beginning my second year as congregation leader in 2004, not yet 50, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. My whole world turned upside down as I faced this life-threatening illness, which of course affected not only myself, but also my team members and impacted the entire congregation. In spite of many apprehensions, I took a leap in faith and made the decision to continue as congregation leader while undergoing treatment. I deeply believe in God's grace and purpose in all things. And from the very beginning, that moment when the doctor told me, I had the extraordinary experience of being lifted beyond myself and held in love and prayer by family, sisters across the congregation, friends, and people I had never met. The experience of that year made me extremely vulnerable, and it softened me. It has helped me to understand suffering and illness and to be more compassionate and accepting of my own and others' frailties and limitations. Leaders are continuously journeying into newness, into the dawning of the new day that takes place within each of us as God beckons us to hope every morning. At his inaugural Mass in St. Peter's Square on the 19th of March, Pope Francis spoke about optimism. Today, amid so much darkness, we need to see the light of hope and to be men and women who bring hope to others. To protect creation, to protect every man and every woman, to look upon them with tenderness and love, is to open up a horizon of hope. With just 1 year to go of my second and final mandate, I can say that I now experience the role and responsibilities of leadership in an international missionary congregation in my bones or in my skin. Thankfully, in religious life at least, the ministry of leadership is not a life sentence. So I'm also aware that it won't be so easy to step back in 12 months' time, and I'm trying to prepare myself for that moment. The prophet Jeremiah bids us stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Which was the good way? Walk in it. And you will find rest for yourselves. I think it is really important to be rooted in our tradition, in the ancient paths. Not in a slavish way, but to draw strength, wisdom, and courage for our paths today. In order to understand the context from which I am speaking, I'll take a few moments to describe the charism of my congregation and our reality today. The Sisters of Our Lady of the Mission were founded in France in 1861. Euphrasie Barbier had a missionary heart and wished to send her sisters to the ends of the earth. So the very first mission of the congregation was to Napier, New Zealand, in 1865, just 3 days after the first group of sisters made their vows. Over the past year, we have been celebrating the 150th anniversary of our foundation, treasuring our past and shaping our future. Our foundress was gifted with a profound insight into the mission of the Trinity. And she explained the first constitutions that the title of the congregation honored the divine mission. The object of Mary's most ardent desire, she said. She was very clear that mission is about the mission of God. And in her own language, she said, we do not need mean our own poor missions, but solely the mission of the incarnate Word sent by God to redeem the human race. And the divine mission of the Holy Spirit sent by the Father and Son to bring about the sanctification of Christ's church. So her understanding of the time did not include mission as partnership, but I believe it would be something very dear to her heart today. Regrettably, when the constitutions were submitted for definitive approbation, the relator of the Congregation of Bishops and Regulars in Rome in 1890 questioned the expression divine mission. And in spite of her very articulate clarification, Euphrasie was forced to remove all traces of the charism and spirituality from the constitutions. The suppression of this text affected deeply the life and mission of the congregation over many decades. And the recovery of the text following Vatican II's challenge to religious to return to the sources has broadened and deepened our understanding of mission. And today, our sisters ponder and treasure Euphrasie's insight, which shapes more clearly our contemplative approach to mission, mission beyond boundaries. The divine mission can never be fully contained or expressed in words or images. The mission of the Trinity is expansive and unrestrained and expresses for us the universality of mission. Euphrasie Barbier was a traveller too. She stopped in Australia several times. She spent a total of 7 years in New Zealand in various visits. She stayed on many of the Pacific Islands and was stranded on Futuna for 9 months when the ship she was supposed to sail on foundered on the reef. She accompanied the first group of sisters to Asia, to Chittagong, which was then part of India, and today the second largest city of Bangladesh. She spent 6 months assisting the sisters to settle into the new mission, and together with them, she learnt Bengali and Hindi. A mission very close to her heart, she returned a second time on her final journey from New Zealand back to Europe. She was backwards and forwards many times to England and to Rome, and was severely criticized by the Marist Fathers and the congregation of bishops and regulars in Rome for traveling too much. She, however, insisted on the need to support her sisters in the mission. Today, RNDMs are about 1,000 women present in 25 countries in Africa, Asia, Europe, North and South America, and the Pacific. While we haven't welcomed any new vocations in Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand for a number of years, annually we have a small group of young women joining us in Africa and Latin America, and very significant numbers in Asia. At present, we are blessed with about 50 novices and 140 sisters in temporary vows. 35% of our membership is under the age of 40. I took up leadership at a very critical time as we live the transition of energy and focus in mission, formation, and leadership from west to east. Managing that transition in ways that are life-giving for all has been part of my task in leadership. So the reflections I offer here are the benefit of hindsight, steep learning curves, initiatives that have worked well, and mistakes that have been made. We can never expect to find all the essential qualities of leadership in any one individual, which is why a team approach to leadership is crucial for any healthy organization, with each member taking responsibility for particular functions in leadership. I believe that there are three key functions of leadership and mission, and I'll take some time to explore each of these roles and include some of the challenges of leadership and mission. Firstly, prophecy and visioning. The role of leadership is to be attentive to the Spirit, to hold extraordinary diversity lightly, to be able to embrace differences of age, culture, ministries, countries, languages, and experience, to engage the imagination of the members in order to shape a common vision for mission, and to initiate and facilitate possibilities for a future full of hope. Secondly, the pastoral care of our members, our partners in mission, and of those with whom we are engaged in mission. The role of leadership to have confidence in the young, to encourage and motivate the seasoned, to listen compassionately to the tired, the sick, and disillusioned, and to draw inspiration and strength from the wisdom of the elderly and support them in their frailty and their final journey towards the loving embrace of their God. And thirdly, administration and the stewardship of resources. The critical role that leadership plays in strategic planning, ensuring the ongoing training of personnel in key positions, and in an increasingly complex global financial reality, engaging the expertise of lay advisors and striving for transparency and best practice in all our undertakings. The role of leadership in prophecy and visioning. The book of Proverbs reminds us that when there is no vision, the people perish. We are very familiar with the role of the prophet in the scriptures, critiquing society and calling the people to fidelity to their covenant with God, to restoring right relationships and insisting on compassion and justice for the poor, the stranger, the widow, and the orphan. Traditionally, prophets have a particular role in society to promote conversion and change through their actions and messages. In very recent years, Sandra Schneiders has written on religious life as prophetic life form, suggesting that at the very heart of ministerial religious life is its participation in the prophetic vocation and mission of Jesus. It is the task of the leadership in religious communities to challenge members to live in fidelity to that prophetic role. As many founders of religious congregations experienced, this prophetic role inevitably invites conflict with the institutional church. And even today, American women religious continue to live this painful reality. One of the principal tasks of leaders in mission is to be attentive to the prophetic voices within the members, among the people with whom we journey in mission, and within society. Leadership must encourage good dreaming. An Aboriginal proverb declares that those who lose dreaming are lost. Joan Chittister insists that the kinds of dreams we have determine the quality of our lives. She argues that the problem is not that we don't dream. The problem is that we seldom dream high enough. The vision for mission is drawn from the dream. And any group needs a very clear vision and mission statement of purpose. Leaders are the custodians of the vision, not in the sense of controlling it, but enabling the vision to unfold and to flourish. Leaders ensure that the mission focus of the members is consistent with the vision. The vision is never static, but is always evolving in fidelity to the founding dream and through lived experience and mission. Leaders constantly engage members in ongoing reflection on the vision and evaluate the mission in relation to the vision. Euphrasie Barbier knew that good dreaming and visioning depended on the openness to the inspiration of the Spirit. She wrote to the sisters on several occasions, urging them to be ever attentive to the whisperings of grace. What a beautiful image for the contemplative approach to mission. In the clutter, clamour, and busyness of each day, it is so easy to miss a whisper and an opportunity. Leaders must be attentive, listening and observing what people need, and have a good knowledge and awareness of the skills, experience, and potential of the members, the institute or organization, in order to be able to articulate a clear vision of mission and to divine pathways to achieve that vision. Mary Noel Father John Sinvillon echoes Euphrasie's understanding that an essential ingredient of the missionary vocation is this practice awareness of living in the presence of God. He writes, "This element of the call to be a missionary is primarily a call to be aware always of the presence of God in our being, in our midst, in our universe, and in what God is revealing. This awareness comes when we affirm that God is with us, and then with patience and discipline, listen to a God who whispers." This attentiveness to the God who whispers helps us to discern global and local mission trends. Leaders need to keep up to date with current missiological thinking
and together with members, establish regular fora to reflect how, in fidelity to the vision, they might best engage in mission with the challenges of our time. Ongoing reflection, discernment, and visioning enable the energy and potential of the members to be continually released and refreshed for mission. An essential aspect of leadership is being able to spot potential and to encourage creativity and initiative in members. Otherwise, we will perish. When I took up leadership in 2002, we had a significantly large group of young women and temporary vows. Most were in Asia and some in Africa and Latin America. In facilitating the transition of energy and focus from west to east, we had to plan carefully for the future. This involved leaders and formators at province level discerning with each young woman a clear plan for her spiritual, theological, and professional studies, as well as helping her to achieve fluency in English. Some we encouraged to specialize at postgraduate level in spirituality, biblical studies, theology, missiology, human development, law, interreligious dialogue, peace studies, etc. Our older sisters in Western provinces have played a critical role in mentoring and accompanying younger sisters in their language acquisition and academic studies. And for several years now, our sisters in Australia and New Zealand, other Western countries, have welcomed young RNDMs from India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Vietnam, Peru, Kenya, and Senegal for long-term studies. There have been significant cultural shifts for everyone, but this has provided mutual enrichment and support and a strong sense of participation in the global missionary life of the congregation. Today, we are very fortunate to have a strong cadre of well-trained, articulate, innovative young women who are well prepared to take up mission in their own countries and beyond. And so, in the past 5 years, we have been able to join collaborative intercongregational ventures. For example, establishing education, health, agricultural infrastructure, and training programs in South Sudan. Our Burmese sisters have joined the Marist Fathers, working with Burmese migrants, many of them illegal, in Thailand. We've established new foundations in Laos, Kazakhstan, and Taiwan, with young RNDM women who exhibit the same courage, passion and zeal as our pioneering women did in New Zealand 150 years ago. In long-established provinces, we have new initiatives in remote and often dangerous parts of India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Vietnam, Philippines, Kenya, and Senegal. In fidelity to our earliest ministries among indigenous peoples, and migrants, mission among these communities remains one of our priorities today. St. Joseph's Māori Girls College was founded in 1867 in Napier, New Zealand, and continues to flourish as one of New Zealand's top educational institutions for Māori youth. Today, we have schools, hostels, and tertiary institutions in tribal communities in many parts of the world. I feel a great sense of pride in the fact that in 1876, 15 years before Rerum Navarum, Efrasi Babie responded to the desperate situation of young migrant factory workers in the north of France and offered a basic education to child labourers, establishing a creche for working mothers whose small children would otherwise roam on the streets, a youth club for older factory girls, and catechism, sacramental preparation for itinerant entertainers, circus children or street entertainers. Today, we are developing new ministries among migrants, with internal migrants who come from rural areas into the mega cities of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and foreign migrant workers in countries like Australia, New Zealand, England, Taiwan, France. 2 years ago, I took an early morning flight from Chittagong to Dhaka in Bangladesh. In spite of the pre-dawn hour, the vehicle was just crawling along, and I was anxious we mightn't get to the airport in time. I thought there must have been a hatal. Hatal is a strike, something which happens very often in Bangladesh and often can be very dangerous. I've just come from Perth, where we had a meeting of our principals of all our schools, secondary schools, and the sisters from Bangladesh were saying that in the month of March, they lost 22 school days because of hatal. And you can imagine what that must be doing to the country at the moment. That was before the fire. So on this day, there were hundreds of thousands of young people on the streets, a great throng moving forward in one direction. When I asked what was going on, I learned that this was a daily occurrence. Workers were making their way to the factories in the export processing zone. Until very recently, young Bangladeshi women lived very protected lives within the family and only rarely went out to work. Today, young migrant workers, many of them from remote tribal communities, are dislocated from their families and only return for 2 or 3 days break a year. They have no job security. Safety measures are often minimal. They are exposed to verbal and sexual abuse. They work long hours for a mere pittance and usually live in appalling conditions. And we have seen in the past few days another tragedy unfold just outside of Dhaka with yet another garment factory fire and more than 250 people engulfed by flames and hundreds still missing. If these young people, most of them women, have children, they have no place to care for them and are obliged to send them back to the countryside to be cared for by grandparents or other relatives. This migration of young people is having major sociological impacts on Bangladesh society and culture. And the same situation is echoed in Vietnam, in India, in the Philippines, in many parts of Asia. Work among migrants in Australia and New Zealand has been taken up by many religious congregations and parish communities for many years, assisting people with language learning, guiding them through complex immigration procedures, ensuring their rights are protected and respected, and accompanying them in the often painful process of integrating more easily into their adopted country. The trafficking of women and children, an abhorrent abuse of our time, has created new forms of slavery, affecting women from parts of Asia and Eastern Europe as well. Those who are most susceptible are women and girls from impoverished and low-income households in rural areas and urban slums, especially women laborers or scavengers, and in other low-status work and services, ethnic minorities, indigenous people, hill tribes, refugees, and illegal migrants are also at risk, as are people who are illiterate or have limited education. Young girls running away from home or girls from families that expect their daughters to financially contribute to their support are vulnerable. These are people who lack awareness of their legal rights, their exploited situation, and have no channel for seeking redress. The last time I was in, we have a mission in the south of Myanmar and a corresponding mission with the Marist Fathers in Thailand, just about 30 minutes across the river. And as we were traveling across the river, the sisters pointed out to me the island, which is well known for the trafficking. Women are brought from rural parts, from hill tribes in different parts of Asia. They're brought to this island and then taken from there to other parts of the world. It is well known, the police know it, and everyone turns a blind eye. Our NDM sisters in India, Myanmar, Taiwan, and England are very involved in ministries among trafficked women. For many years, religious congregations have been forging new partnerships with lay associates and advisors, with schools and other religious congregations. Sorry, wrong way. In the South Sudan, I see a new model of mission. More than 200 religious congregations support collaborative ministries in 6 centres in South Sudan, training teachers, health workers, pastoral ministers, and agriculturalists. Religious and clergy live together in international and intercongregational communities. We have 6 sisters from our congregation. After 40 years of war, the entire infrastructure of the country was destroyed. The majority of people had to flee to refugee camps in neighboring African countries or to seek asylum in Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand. The first time I visited in 2007, when I saw school buildings with no doors or windows, children eager to learn, sitting on bricks or under trees and writing on the dust and the floor. Churches had no roofs. The faces of the people were grim and somewhat mistrustful. And this man, Francis, accompanied us on a 13-hour journey from Yambio to Juba, leaving in the early hours of the morning, one of the most frightening journeys I have ever experienced. And he was our bodyguard. We were actually stopped twice. The first time, after about 45 minutes, the vehicle was surrounded by men with bows and arrows. And fortunately, the parish priest had insisted on coming with us, and he explained who we were. I'm not sure what Francis was doing at the time, but we managed to have safe passage. And the second time, about half an hour later, we were surrounded by men with machine guns. And again, the parish priest explained, "I've never prayed so much for the dawn to come, to see light, to be able to see." It was such a terrifying experience. And still today, the men and women, religious and lay, of Solidarity are facing a lot of tension, a lot of violence in the communities where they're living. They are incredibly courageous people. So this groundbreaking initiative on the part of the International Union of Superiors General, male and female, at the request of the bishops of South Sudan, is an enormous contribution towards reconstruction of a new country and society. It is also imaging new approaches to mission among religious and lay volunteers as they live together in mixed communities. Mission is not just about what we do in mission, but it's also about offering possibilities for others to share in our mission. Many religious congregations have developed programs for young people in their gap years, and for skilled volunteers to participate in collaborative mission ventures, such as the Marist Mission in Thailand, where the Marist Fathers work alongside lay associates and volunteers from the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, Italy, and other parts of Europe, plus 2 young Burmese RNDMs working with Burmese migrant workers. They've developed an excellent education program for children and youth, as well as health, pastoral and other social services. In formal education, Catholic schools can be described as one of the key missionary arms of the Church. In Australia and New Zealand, Catholic schools foster a strong social conscience and missionary outreach of their students and offer scholarships for children from poorer families. Many schools develop strong connections and relationships with educational institutions in other parts of the world. Student and teacher exchanges have been common for many years, but increasingly, schools are partnering schools in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Pacific. Our own schools in Australia and New Zealand have adopted RNDM missions in India, Vietnam, and the Philippines. And students and teachers and parents raise funds, organize visits each year to teach English, paint classrooms, and construct sports fields. These exchanges widen the horizons of all involved and are experiences of mission that young people will never forget. An essential role of leadership is the pastoral care of members and partners in mission. Leaders are not only responsible for ensuring the physical, mental, and spiritual care of the sick and elderly members, but also to honour the mellow fruitfulness of their seniors, sharing with them the story of mission today, inviting their opinions, and above all, requesting their prayer. When I'm facing some difficult situations, I know exactly where I can go to for support and prayer, and it's something that I experience very tangibly. Drawing on the skills and experience and mature wisdom of those in their middle years and celebrating the dynamism, energy, creativity and imagination of the young is so vital for the life and future of any organization. A leader needs to be able to recognize the potential of each member and to affirm, encourage and instill in her a belief in her own inner beauty and giftedness. Opportunities for renewal and professional upgrading enable members to feel valued, confident, and professional in their ministry. Consulting, engaging, and delegating others is critical in helping a group to own a particular project or to effect change. Whenever I visit provinces and regions of the congregation, I always try to meet the sisters individually. 10 days ago, I was in Vietnam, which is now our largest province, where more than 70% of the sisters are under the age of 50. In a marathon effort over 2 weeks, I met 132 sisters individually. Wherever I go in the congregation, I always feel humbled and profoundly enriched by the personal story of each sister, her fidelity, her passion for the poor, and her vision for mission. I feel it is an extraordinary privilege to touch the sacred ground of people's stories, many of whom, especially in Vietnam and some of our other provinces, have suffered so much over the years in ways that I can never begin to imagine. Yet their cheerfulness, profound faith, and strong zeal for mission inspire me, energize me, and give me enormous hope for the future. Wherever we are engaged in mission today, locally or internationally, the context is multicultural for all of us here. We cannot insist that there is only one correct way to live that mission. Certainly, there are challenges and misunderstandings, but there is extraordinary richness and beauty in living the Pentecost vision, where each member hears and speaks the word in her own tongue. One of the tasks of the leader then is to create a comfortable environment where each member of the community or of the staff respects the other and is encouraged to share the richness of language, culture, and tradition. In our communities, the ideal we strive for is to nurture relationships that are life-giving and based on a spirit of trust, cultural sensitivity, mutual respect, appreciation, and encouragement. In an international missionary congregation such as ours, where intercultural and international communities are the norm, questions and challenges of enculturation versus internationality inevitably arise and must be explored and revisited regularly. I think this is a question that many missionary institutes are grappling with now. Some of our members feel that real efforts at enculturation are often sacrificed to embrace the diversity of cultures within the group, in food, expressions of hospitality, liturgy and prayer styles, forms of relaxation, sense of humour, medium of communication, and even dress. In the interests of smooth personal relationships and mutual understanding, a lot of energy does, of necessity, go into reflecting and sharing on cultural difference. Strong communal values and respect for the elder or the personal authority in the East can clash with the sometimes fierce individualism and self-reliance of the West. It takes enormous courage to be able to name painful experiences of intolerance, prejudice, and even identify the racism that lurks within each of us and which can be triggered unexpectedly. However, when honest and rich exchanges are possible, they can lead to a greater sense of interdependence and inner directedness of the young. I'd just like to finish by saying that leaders are expected to be superhuman perfect people, an impossible dream. Leaders have to be dreamers, visionaries, diplomats, counselors, strategists, teachers, confessors, healers, and managers. They have to multitask and keep 1,001 things in their mind. They need good memories to remember names, faces, places of mission, and to be able to forget personal hurts, conflicts, and betrayals. They must be sensitive and compassionate, have broad shoulders to accept criticism, cope with confrontation, and to be willing to try and resolve conflicts. They need a sense of humor, and they have to be able to laugh at themselves. They must take courageous and unpopular decisions and be ready to stand for them. There will be times when they have to let go an idea they hold dearly, or they may even be obliged to compromise for the sake of a greater good. They will know moments of overwhelming joy and sense of accomplishment, but they will also experience corresponding moments of great loss, loneliness, and desolation. Friends may not always stand alongside them. They will become discouraged and disillusioned. They will please some of the people some of the time, but definitely not all of the people all of the time. They need gifts of inner strength and resilience, humility and simplicity, and the readiness to admit, I was wrong, and to say, I am sorry. Leaders must be grounded in the reality of the present and have an eye for the future. They need time to rest, to lick wounds, in order to be able to ponder and wonder again. I have a favorite quote from Etty Hillison that for the past 11 years I have kept on the board in front of my computer. It keeps me motivated. She wrote, "There are moments when I feel like giving up or giving in, but I soon rally again and do my duty as I see it to keep the spark of life inside me." After 11 years in leadership, I believe even more profoundly in the whisperings of God's grace and in the serendipitous presence, power, and passion of the Spirit.
Thank you so much, Sister Maureen. Thank you for speaking to us, not of diminishment, but of new light and new hope, of walking ancient paths in new ways. And I think it was quite sobering to hear that accurate and long list of the many things that we expect of our leaders. To respond to Sister Maureen, we have Dr. Therese Dorser, who's so very well known in missiology and education circles that I'll say just one thing about her. And that is that you can buy her books upstairs on level 4.
Thank you. Thank you. Sister Maureen, I'm sorry to have my back to you after that splendid effort. And I must say, it does sound feel a bit superfluous after so much wisdom to want to pile it on and say something else. But I did have notes from Maureen and in the last few days, and a few thoughts came to me which I thought were important, so I'll just offer them quickly. When Maureen started, she was quite poetic. She was up in the cockpit and she was describing a beautiful dawn and so on, and she talked about checking the instruments, verifying the maps and setting the flight path. And I thought about maps. Verifying the maps, yes. You don't want to be on your way to Auckland if you're meant to be going into Rome. But I'd like to push the metaphor a bit further. In the globalised world to which we belong, in which we function in our missionary lives, life is exceedingly complex. And we actually have to create the maps. We have to venture out with the bit of knowledge that we have in all these apostolates that beckon, and we have to actually chart as we go along. Like the map makers of old, we go along, we make our charts, we come back home, we've got it drawn up. Somebody else has been out and done a similar journey, we compare notes and we try and get it right. In the end, our map might look a bit like Cape York Peninsula, disoriented to the right, but after much dialogue, people did create very good maps. There is a difference for us today. Cape York isn't quite what Cape York once was. We are not actually functioning in a world where things stay stable. We work with shifting sands. So, not only must we be prepared to make maps, we must always have our maps in our mind as provisional guides only. We do have to actually make and remake our maps as we share wisdom and learn from one another and learn the nature of what's in front of us and what we must do. Secondly, Maureen mentioned Pope Francis, and haven't we all been watching this keenly and closely, his orientation, what he's on about and so on. And I think he's a man that understands symbolic action very well. And his symbolic action is very powerful because it's backed up with real commitment. Now, just to give you an idea of how powerful I think this is, the other day, a couple of weeks ago, I was getting around on crutches and getting depressed because I couldn't do the house. It was untidy. And my young sister, Byrne, who doesn't actually darken the church door very often, she drives 60 miles on her day off, comes in with her super-duper vacuum cleaner, and she's going to clean up the house for me so I'm going to feel better. So she comes in, she says, "Hi, Terry, hi, Jim." And then she pauses and she says, "What about this Pope?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, he's a good man," and so on. She said, "What about him washing the feet of those juveniles from the juvenile detention centre?" Then she pauses and she says, "They will always know they are worth something." And I thought, just the power of that, the interest she had, it had hit her very hard. She thought it was wonderful. She loves young people. And that was real evangelization. So I think in our missional lives, we might think about the power of symbolic action a little bit more. The other thing I want to take up briefly, you mentioned about when Mother Euphrasia Barbier had to take out that wonderful phrase about divine mission out of the constitutions. Now, I don't know whether that was because the person in charge in Rome was invincibly ignorant, or because the person, he couldn't be where he wasn't. He couldn't be ahead of where, he couldn't have perhaps the learnings that have come to us the hard way now. But whatever it is, it made me think of something that the postmodern philosophers have taught me. And that is not just that knowledge is power, I've known that as an educator for a long time, but that power is knowledge. Them that's got the power can create the knowledge. So if we're in our missional lives, we do a lot of theologizing, we do a lot of meaning making with people, we've got to make sure that we are doing that with them, we are listening, and that we are open, and that we are not dominating with an insight that is not where the play is. So that openness, which we didn't see in that case, which I think is a very humble openness to the Holy Spirit. A lot has been said about the Holy Spirit today. The fourth thing, and there's only five, you'll be pleased to know, the fourth thing that I thought Maureen did helped us very much, she put an emphasis on the pastoral care of the people of the congregation. And in a talk on missional leadership, that meant a lot to me, because I think we've got a very big problem in our church, and that is it's to do with the Western mindset that we cart around and we can't really avoid. And there's mission here and there's pastoral care there. There's a pastoral missional divide. Instead of pastoral care of the community being so that we have a vibrant community for mission. They are integrated, two sides of the one coin, if you like, but somehow we seem to like to divide them up, and it has had very bad consequences on a lot of Catholics. They don't really see this mission thing as very confusing to them. They still can't get away from the fact that it can be, and it is, about where I'm called to be in the here and now to create the kingdom of God where I am. And in the education sector, we have a lot of problems where schools are meant to create vibrant mission statements coming out of the community's discernment, and the parishes they serve don't see any point to all that because they know what their mission is. Finally, Maureen talked about when she talked about the right use of resources, she talked about strategic planning. Now, I've been in educational leadership for a long time, and a few years ago, we used to, when we wanted to appoint principals, we'd say, that person's got the faith, and they're also a good operator. So they'd be good as a principal. As time went by, we learnt that you have to be more than a good operator and keep the show going. You have to be able to plan strategically over a period of time, harness your resources, and get on with the job in a flexible way. So strategic thinking came into it. But now we realise that it's not just a matter of having the faith, you have to have missional competence. So there's mission thinking, or missional competence, strategic competence, and operational competence. The mission has to drive the strategic and the operational. So that's what we look for in leaders, those three. And I think that's a pretty big ask. So there's a lot of training we have to do in all our Catholic institutions to make sure mission drives the organisation. So I'll leave it at that. And I do think there's much more, but in the notes I got from Maureen, I'm not like the man who prepared his response and found out the person had left out most of the bits he was going to talk about. Maureen had added quite a few bits, and they speak for themselves, so thank you.
Thank you, Therese. So, we've heard from two wise women leaders of deep experience. We have little time now for questions. And then I'll make some announcements about the movements for the rest of the afternoon. But we do have a little time for questions. Just looking around to make sure that our people with microphones are at their stations. Yes, we've got one upstairs and two downstairs. Who would like to speak first? Right at the back, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Maureen. I have a question about, as you went around the globe visiting your communities, have you ever come across a community which initially, following the charism of your foundress and your own guidance, changed their apostolate somewhat, maybe even against your vision or against even your wishes, but that apostolate has proven in the long run to be actually God-given? By their fruits you will know them. Can you share anything like that where if a community has departed, going a way that you would rather not go, and yet you have allowed it to go on and it has borne fruit? Thank you.
So can prophecy and formal leadership sometimes not be in quite the same place at the same time?
I can think of some places where we mightn't always be in accord with each other, some of the missions that we have. I can think of places which for a long time flourished, and there was certainly a sense of divergence, not only with my leadership but previous leaderships. It was put in relation to a way of caring for young children and orphans, and I think there would still be some concerns about that mission today, but a point arose where we could no longer consent because of what we've become much more aware of in the way to relate with young people, to care for young people, and boundaries and so on that have to be put in place. And so we actually distanced ourselves from that mission. I can't think of an example of the kind that you're talking about. I would say that in the South Sudan, which is a collaborative mission with many, many different religious congregations, that's something that is, I believe, the Spirit is unleashing and is growing and evolving, where member congregations might have gone in with a strong identity of who they were, but who, in fact, are living into a new identity as collaborative missionaries, letting go their own particular way of praying and doing things. I think that's a wonderful example, perhaps, of what you might be hinting at.
Thank you, Maureen. I'm looking around again to see who else wants to speak. Martin in the front.
So there's a conversation about that every young woman in formation was supported spiritually, physically, academically, and in other ways. There's enormous, and then you also talked about the fact that you've got schools in Australia, and obviously lay leadership will be coming through those schools. Can you comment on the apparent enormous disparity between the formation time and intensity for religious, even your continuing religious, and for lay people who are going into similar roles? So they say that that formation for religious and priests is measured in years and for lay people in hours.
I think that's a very good question, actually, and very true, and I'm not sure that I can say too much about it other than I've just come from an education symposium in Perth where we had the principals of all our secondary schools, so from Australia, New Zealand and England, they were lay people,
and from India and Bangladesh. They were religious from our own congregation. And what we experienced there was the incredible depth of knowledge and love that the our lay partners in mission have for the educational tradition that they have moved into, an extraordinary preparation. And our sisters felt a great sense of not only awe, but a sense of shame that they themselves didn't have the kind of way of fostering that spirit in the schools. Certainly, yes, we have up until final vows, it takes about 10 years to prepare a religious to make their final profession. And a lay person going into a school, for example, would do their degrees 4 or 5 years, maybe. But in terms of the religious preparation, it's a lifelong preparation for all of us and whatever our walk of life.
Thank you, Maureen. We might also ask Therese, as a laywoman, to respond a little to that too.
Well, just Martin, that I agree that that is everything. And it's occurred to me in my work in the last couple of years that we in this country have moved into a fourth era of Catholic education. We had the lay people first, and then for nearly 100 years we had the staffing being done by religious and the formation that went with that. And then we moved into another era, began in the 70s and went up till fairly recently, and we did put in a lot of time and a lot of effort into the development of people. But I think now we've got into a new era where not only do we have to keep doing all that, we've also challenged in another way in terms of people have to understand how knowledge is constructed and secularisation and all these areas. But we've never left that challenge behind, but I fear that we might think we're in a new era and we've been there and we've done that. We've slackened off. Because we've got new challenges, we've slackened off with the previous challenge, but that challenge of the formation of people is everything. Without that, we are going nowhere. So I just think that's number one, but it's got to go be lifelong. And I think in places like ACU and BBI, we can do a certain amount of that through our courses, but I think at the diocesan and congregational level, we've got to complement that with formation. They're not the same thing.
So not so much sequential challenges, but cumulative challenges. We have time, I think, for maybe one or two more questions. Yes, in the middle here. And then after, we'll take one from upstairs. Microphone making its way across the corridor there. Yep.
Hi. Sister, I was wondering, as a Year 12 student and a member of the youth myself, obviously you've seen a lot of change and development in leadership. And I was wondering, how do you think that leadership should, will and can change in the future to encompass especially the youth in this mission work?
A big question. Thank you.
I think it's critical that leaders in mission, wherever they are and whatever, the lay, religious, clergy, that all of us have to be listening very attentively, particularly to the young people, because they have the vibes of what is happening in our world today very closely. And not only to listen, but also to engage them very actively in the life and decision-making of the organisation. And I have an experience with a group of lay people from Singapore. I can't remember the name of the parish, although I go there quite regularly. They're an extraordinary parish. The It's a very multicultural place. The church is always full. They have about 7 or 8 masses, and it's always the young people who are leading the liturgies, any mass that I go to there. But not only that, each group in the parish has an outreach, mission outreach, and one of them is to a group of our sisters in Vietnam. And it's young people, again, who really do a lot of the fundraising and the organizing, and they plan for that mission, what exactly they're going to do there. They dialogue with the group of sisters in the community where they're going, and work with the children in that mission. I think it's a wonderful model, and it's preparing them for future, helping them to understand and to evaluate and be part of forward directions in life. And I hope that kind of model of a parish life can touch all of us in our parishes wherever we are, particularly the young.
So different generations working alongside one another, transferring knowledge, experience, but also energy in the other direction too. We have one last question. Thank you.
Sister, I'm Father Elmer from Wellington in New Zealand, and I attend every year. We have a meeting of the Congregational Leaders of Aotearoa New Zealand, which happens in Wellington. And in those meetings, the topic of winding down of congregations has always been coming up. So as a congregational leader, I think it is very, very difficult if there would come a time that a congregation, or at least a province or a district of a congregation in a particular country, would now be winding down its work. Now, as a congregational leader, I just want to ask, what do you think about this phenomena that is happening, particularly in the Western world?
Certainly that's happening for us in our Western provinces, and probably the one that is moving the most rapidly towards that would be our Australian province, and some of them are here today. But they have been planning for that moment and for the handover for many years, really preparing themselves, but also engaging with lay partners, both in the schools and in many, many ways. And so it's been a very conscious decision for them and a very conscious planning. And I'm in awe of the courage in which our sisters here in Australia have, and other provinces that would be moving towards that kind of reality. At the same time, as I mentioned, our sisters in the Western provinces, again here in Australia, as in New Zealand too, have welcomed young sisters from other parts of the world to partner them, to accompany them in their professional studies and language acquisition. But it's much, much more than that. It's about sharing a life and vision together that is mutually enriching. But it's certainly one of the challenges for us in our congregation, as it is for many other congregations.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking Maureen and Therese.